Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. We have a great show for you today, as we always do each week. We're talking about all things law enforcement. We'll have a guest in the interview room, and then we will talk about my view from the blue, and that's what we're going to go do right now.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
Something is rotten in Philadelphia. In what I can only describe as people getting what they ask for, the Philadelphia District Attorney has just been elected. And when I tell you that it was George Soros' money that helped him get elected, I think you'll probably know where this story is going. The guy's name is Larry Krasner. Now, the district attorney is the individual who is responsible for choosing which cases to prosecute, which cases not to, and basically sets the tone for all things prosecution-wise in a city. And this guy, Krasner, was elected. Now, let me just give you a little bit of background about this moron. He's a civil rights attorney, okay? He's represented Black Lives Matter pro bono and has sued the police department more than 75 times. And this is the guy that was just elected as the next district attorney. He has literally put criminals back on the streets and evidence a strong anti-law enforcement predominance. He is dedicated to a really, really liberal agenda, and that includes a plan this is shocking, to end cash bail and any bail policy where poor people are incarcerated pending trial. He also vows not to jail nonviolent criminals and has also promised to never seek the death penalty. So here we got a guy who is going to be the head of the prosecuting attorney for the entire city of Philadelphia. And he has already said, I'm just not going to go for the death penalty. So he doesn't care about the heinousness of the crime. He doesn't care what the law of the land is. Much like that moronic state's attorney down in Florida, who the governor was at least smart enough to take away her powers when it came down to capital cases, this guy is going to make the decision. Now, regarding the bail stuff, now think of this. People come to court because they have to come to court, not because they want to come to court. So you get arrested for burglary or selling drugs or whatever, and they're going to just release you on your own recognizance and hope that you show up back in court. What this is going to do is going to overburden the criminal justice system in such a way, because they're, of course, not going to appear in court. That means they're going to be issuing warrants for their arrest. It just circumvents the system and makes it a far more difficult method to incarcerate people, which, of course, is what he is trying to do. Now, when he says that he vows not to jail nonviolent offenders. So, why would you not commit the crimes of burglary? Why would you not commit other crimes like heavy narcotics offenses when you have just been told by the district attorney you're never going to have to go to jail? This guy is an idiot. He's a complete and utter moron who is dedicated to the socialist type of philosophies that George Soros and his friends at Black Lives Matter and Antifa and all the other socialist groups that he has funded. he is the fox is now seriously in the hen house in Philadelphia. Now Philadelphia has had a lot of issues, a lot of issues over there, criminal justice wise, and instead of taking the bull by the horns and electing someone that's going to actually be tough on crime, the people who have voted put this guy in, and they are going to be the future victims. It's absurd. You know, I know that there is a saying that you know, you get what you vote for. You know, I can't think of a better demonstration of that. Now, I can't imagine the damage that this individual Krasner is going to do when he gets in office. I know one thing. I sure am glad I'm not a cop in Philadelphia, because with a guy like this at the helm, I can imagine that assaults and attacks on law enforcement are going to rise. The offenders are going to know within minutes of this guy taking office, and when he signals that he's not going to put offenders in jail that do anything other than violent crimes, this is going to be a serious issue. This is going to really make the streets of Philadelphia far more dangerous than they are now, and believe me, it's no walk in the park now. The law enforcement response to this election has been pretty crazy. 12 former district attorneys' office employees have issued an open letter condemning Krasner as dangerous and pointed out the obvious, that it's hard to lead an office of people you have repeatedly branded as liars. Now, in addition to that, the police officers have also weighed in on this. They have started a social media campaign with hashtag not my DA, and but the damage is already done. He's been elected. He's there. So it's not a good time to be in law enforcement in Philadelphia. It's not a good time to be a citizen in Philadelphia, because the keys to the kingdom were just handed over to a radical anti-law enforcement attorney who is now going to be in charge of prosecuting criminals in Philadelphia. So I'm sure I'll be speaking about this guy more in the future as he continues to show his political leanings, and we see what the damage that will be done to the citizens of Philadelphia. I will keep you certainly advised of that, because this is going to need to be spoken about. Now, while we're on the subject of law enforcement and the difficulties facing the American law enforcement officer, there was just an article that I want to talk about, and it was from a chief in North Carolina, and he issued basically a press release about the difficulties in recruiting qualified people. Now, it's no surprise to any of us, that there is a difficult road taking place now because of all the anti-law enforcement sentiment, because there has been such horrible law enforcement leadership on a national level. And so what's happening is people simply aren't going for the job. This is going to have really serious ramifications later on, and it already is now. You know, this North Carolina chief, he talked about the social media and high-profile shootings making the hiring of officers more difficult. And of course, I'm glad he's coming out publicly, because we all know that it's true. So, you know, what I am suggesting that we need to look at this as on a national level. Now, there are ways that we can combat this and it can be done effectively. It really, truly isn't rocket science, but it takes leadership at the highest levels of government. First of all, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which are all the big bosses in law enforcement, needs to come to the table and start acting responsibly and acting like leaders instead of the some politically acceptable social club for bosses, which is what they seem to have become. In addition to that, the National Sheriff's Association needs to step to the table, and our political leaders, because this is going to take a combined effort if we are going to turn the tide and create effective law enforcement in this country, retain suitable police officers, hire suitable police officers. And what I'm going to suggest is might be seen as radical considering what has taken place in the last few years. See, what's been happening, especially under the Obama administration and the Holder Department of Justice, what they tried to do, and they really made an effort, and they were somewhat successful, is in changing the paradigm of hiring. They actually wanted, and were successful in some cases, to allow criminals to become law enforcement officers. They wanted to adjust, quote unquote, the hiring practices, thereby giving, in the name of diversity, which of course is the all-powerful word in law enforcement hiring these days. They wanted to give the opportunity to people who were drug offenders, who had been convicted of crimes, to now become police officers, and they were effective in certain areas. Most police agencies said, no, we're not doing that, but some did. Now, that shows the far left part of this equation. What I am going to suggest is quite the opposite. If we are to embrace good, solid candidates that have a desire to serve, we need to make it easier for them and more make it a much more resilient kind of job. When I say that, I mean this. It's time that we looked at standardizing salaries. Now, if that sounds a little weird, I want to point this out to you. About a year ago, I reported on a police officer being killed in the line of duty, 25-year veteran in rural Pennsylvania. He was killed during a domestic. And I later heard from one of his coworkers, and I verified this. He was making $9.11 an hour or something like that. We're paying police officers $9 an hour to risk their lives. Now, first of all, you got to be crazy to do this job for $9 an hour. Secondly, what are the candidates that are going to apply for this job? So we need to look at this salary range and say, you know what, for anywhere in the nation, you cannot offer police officers anything less than X amount, whether it's $35,000, $40,000, something, because right now, This pay schedule is so across all over the place. You know, you go to one town in Louisiana and your starting pay is $24,000 a year. You go to a police department in New Jersey and you start out at $60,000 a year. And it's all over the board. We need to create some type of standardization, because that will draw more people if you pay them well. Now, there's also been a trend to diminish benefits. Now, this is the craziest thing I ever heard. We got the worst time in history to be a police officer. They're facing increasing dangers, both physically, emotionally, psychologically. And what do we tell them? Instead of 25 years, we want you to do 30 years. In fact, we don't even want you to be able to retire until you're 60 years old. And that's happening in places all over the country. Instead of making the job benefits better to recruit people, to bring people in that are of high enough intelligence and desire for a job that requires so much out of them. We're making it more difficult. We're basically saying, hey, you know what? We're going to make it as terrible for you as possible, but come on and become a cop. We're going to pay you terribly. We're not going to take care of you as far as your retirement goes. In fact, pension systems are going by the wayside. They're making guys create savings accounts or 401ks. Well, you know what? This isn't corporate America. These guys only make a certain salary, and the salaries generally are not that high. That was one of the biggest draws for hiring, by making sure that they were taken care of when they retired. Now, that's going by the wayside. So we're doing everything back-asswards here. Instead of going out and making the police job as difficult as it is, to make it at least somewhat palatable and give people the incentive to join, we're making just the opposite. And who's doing this? It's law enforcement leaders, and it's city leaders and community politicians, all because they want to try and save a buck. This is going to have serious ramifications in the years to come. And when I say serious ramifications, I mean, first of all, we're going to hire less than adequate police officers. Secondly, we are going to have people that remain on the job who are not committed to it. And then third, they're not going to stay. So we're going to be in this cycle of idiocy here. And I'm not hearing anyone in politics or in law enforcement leadership addressing it. It's something that needs to be done vitally. It needs to be done now. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. I want to take a minute and tell you about an incredible security company. Now, I've dealt with a lot of security folks, and some have been less than professional. This company is amazing, JSD Protective Services. Now, they're all over the country, and they do amazing stuff. They're armed security, they do courier work, they do private investigations, they do it all, and they do it well. And the reason that they do it so well is because of their training. They put their folks through some amazing training that's very comparable to law enforcement training. So JSD Protective Services, they're all over the United States, and you can find them at jsdprotectiveservices.com. That's jsdprotectiveservices.com. For all your security needs, they are the best. Give them a call. Or actually, hit them up on their website, jsdprotectiveservices.com. Before we take a walk into the interview room, one thing I wanted to let you know is that I recently had the honor of being a keynote speaker down in Texas. And I got to tell you that one of the things that I really enjoy is getting to meet personally with the people that listen to this radio program. So if you would like to talk to me about addressing your group, whether it is a law enforcement or a civic group or even a volunteer group, let me know. Contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Thanks. Now let's take a walk into the interview room.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a veritable icon in the law enforcement training profession. His name is Dennis Anderson. Dennis has been not only instrumental in changing the paradigm of law enforcement survival training, but without a doubt, his activities in this area have saved the lives of untold numbers of law enforcement officers. He began Caliber Press and the Street Survivor seminars, which still go to this day. Dennis, thank you so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Randy, I'm very, very excited about chatting with you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to put a little personal note in here, and that is that when I was a young police officer, I started in 1976. And I went to the New Jersey State Police Academy, which was a very well run, very well respected academy, and they had an emphasis on law enforcement survival training. But it wasn't until I attended my first Caliber Press Street Survival Seminar that I really began to take it seriously. And I got to tell you, I believe it was instrumental in saving my own life during my first critical incident, fatal shooting. And I want to thank you from personally about from what you have accomplished in this area.
Well, thank you, and that means so much to hear that.
So you've been in the police training field for literally for decades. Let's go back to the origins. And what was it that got you interested in quite literally changing the training paradigm for officer survival training?
Well, in 1978, I produced and directed a training film slide manual package called Survival Shooting Techniques. And that really revolutionized the way officers learned about shooting firearms. Prior to that, it was just a lot of talk about the fact that officers died, but very little on what you do to either prevent a shooting or come out on top if it's inevitable. So that is really, really the origin of where things began.
Well, you've put a tremendous, you made a career out of this, basically. And it was something that had not been done before, at least in a national way. You know, there might have been localized training in this regard, but you took it to an entirely different level. And what was it that not only motivated you, but gave you the skill level to create that first book, Street Survival for Law Enforcement Armed Encounters?
Well, the Street Survival book really came out of the tremendous amount of research that my partner, Chuck Remsburg, and I had acquired in conjunction with my making the Survival Shooting Techniques movie. And we really felt that this was, extremely valuable information that needed to be shared. The second thing that took place is that I spent a lot of time when I moved to Chicago and went to work for Motorola Teleprograms. I sat in a lot of training classes, and I was quite shocked at how archaic the teaching methods were, and also the way in which offender behavior was demonstrated in a classroom setting or in a hands-on setting, where the bad guys never moved or took action, and the only thing the officers found out about was the fact that, well, they should do this and then this and then this, Well, that's great if you've got a cooperative subject, but if the subject is, jacked up on drugs, totally uncooperative, argumentative, 6 inches taller and 100 pounds heavier, you got yourself a whole different environment. And at the time, that really wasn't addressed, nor was the reality of the kinds of statistics of how officers get shot and killed in the line of duty in terms of distance, light level, numbers of shots fired, and a lot of other things. It just wasn't shared information. And at the time, departments did a very poor job of sharing information, because a lot of times when an officer was shot, or particularly when the officer was killed in the line of duty, this is information that departments didn't want to share. They didn't even want to acknowledge that such a death had taken place. So there were a lot of inhibiting forces in terms of advancing law enforcement officer education as it related to patrol procedures. A real key turning point for me was coming up with an idea that, like in business, when you want to succeed, you find out what your competition is up to. I found it interesting that no one had spent any time with cop killers and what they did to defeat officers. So through the Illinois Department of Corrections, I went about interviewing five cop killers, all each serving about 400-year sentences, and found out what their thinking was. What was their experience with firearms? What did they have in mind when they pulled off their stick up or whatever? This was all new information in the law enforcement world, because the offender's ability to articulate what their thinking was, what their planning was, the fact that a lot of them, hell, they'd never even held a gun until they reached the day when they decided to fire. All they had done is played video games. And that psychomotor skill of learning to shoot something and then get on target was ingrained in them to the extent that when they actually fired a firearm, they were pretty accurate. And you compare that with a lot of officers who were still shooting at great distances, like the FBI taught 50 years ago. You know, this all needed major update based, again, on the threat that offenders posed for officers.
You know, it's funny you should say it. I was thinking about when I became a policeman in New Jersey, and I was there for 10 years. I remember that our qualification, our firearms qualification, consisted of firing about 50 rounds very basic stances, and that was it. I mean, you did that once a year, if you were lucky, and it was no type of applicable tactics. There was nothing about the mindset that you need to go into combat. It just didn't exist. And that was at that time we were seeing hundreds of law enforcement officers being killed in the line of duty. Hundreds. And I got to say that I think that your efforts in creating the training programs that you did, I think saved hundreds of officers' lives a year.
Well, thanks a million. You know, one of the things that became very irritating was to find out what plaintiff's attorneys do to try to destroy officers who've been involved in litigation related to use of force or use of deadly force. And one of the things that inevitably gets dragged into court is the officer's training records. And if an officer has never received training in low light level shooting moving objects, or any of the other parameters that affect the reality of an armed confrontation, it's very easy for these people to prove that the officer just wasn't trained and proficient and qualified to be discharging his weapon at offender X. And in many cases, it was true that the officer just was not effectively trained in how to shoot a pistol.
Well, that's pretty scary. You know, the thought of police officers not being trained in deadly force situations is something that is unbelievable in these days. And yet still, when you go to police agencies now, very often the training requirements, instead of being geared towards officer survival training, seems to be being given an emphasis on things like de-escalation and verbal techniques to defuse situations. And it almost seems that that survival, which is to me the key area, is now taking a back seat to some of the more politically correct training.
You have just made a very significant point, because when Caliber Press started doing the Street Survival Seminar, we eventually did over 700 three-day seminars. The gradual adaptation that occurred in recruit academies and in-service training was to become more focused on issues that related to patrol survival, absolutely, for sure. So then you take a recruit school of X number of hours, let's say 400 hours to crank out a law enforcement officer. Well, what's happened is that with the emphasis on all the political correct bullshit, the amount of time available to accommodate new topics of interest has not been added to that training. It's been replaced. In other words, the amount of time it takes for sensitivity training about the transgender folk or homosexuals or people of a particular religious orientation, you know, that's consistent with interest in the times, and the community has an interest in officers knowing these things. But to take away time from learning arrest and control techniques, from practicing high-risk vehicle stops, from becoming proficient with a long gun and also a pistol, is just really a scary ledge to be out on. And that's what we're faced with. That's why you've got officers, and you see this all the time in the news, the mistakes that get made. These are not uncaring, stupid officers. That would be a ridiculous conclusion that only the news media could make. We're talking about people who are undertrained, and it's undertraining because sufficient time just doesn't exist for all of these topics to be included. So what do they knock out? Well, they knock out all the evil things like those situations that threaten an officer's safety. They don't relate to that. Now, they want to relate to the touchy-feely stuff, which, you know, is nice, but again, there's only X amount of time, and what's most important? Every state has a peace officer standards and training board, and they're mandated to give minimum standards and training for every peace officer. Well, these things have become so diluted that you have officers who just, you know, are in harm's way when they go on patrol. And that's wrong.
I couldn't agree more. And what you're saying is absolutely right on. You know, when I look at some of the high-profile shooting incidents that have taken place, and I want to point out one that of course was highly spoken about, and it was the Tamir Rice shooting in Cleveland, or in Ohio. I think it was Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
When that happened, it was of course a 12-year-old who was shot and killed, and he had what turned out to be a toy gun. The officers didn't know that, of course, but some of the techniques that were utilized during that what led up to the shooting were highly questionable. So I looked at the training hours that were required in Ohio, and I was absolutely shocked to see, first of all, that the standard basic academies were fairly short. I think the mandatory was 600 hours, but it was the annual training which was shocking. It was 2 hours a year, Dennis. 2 hours a year is what they gave these officers in advanced training to requirements.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. Because
the Ohio State Academy is one of the finest in the country. But you see, you know, the staff is hot to deal with this, but they're just not allowed to.
Well, and not so only that, Dennis, but here's what else I found out. That there had been a state Senate investigation before the Tamir Rice shooting about the number of hours that these officers were being given in advanced training. And the finding was that they were given inadequate training and that it needed to be up to, I think it was 12 hours, which is still nothing. And you know what they did? Nothing. They did nothing. And they said, well, we just can't afford to train them.
See, they don't have the money to train them, but they have the money to bury them.
Isn't that the
truth?
And
that's wrong.
Isn't that the truth? That's exactly...
That's absolutely wrong. You know, there should be a component in every police academy in America, every in-service program that deals with fitness. 12 officers so far this year have died in the line of duty from heart attacks.
Yeah.
And when you take a look at what the offenders do, and typically they're at their peak performance at night and are typically jacked up on something, and you know, what's their level of mental and physical fitness versus the average officer? Who's going to win that great battle? It's the one that's prepared. It's the one that takes it on personal. You know, we saw an increasing popularity and attendance at our street survival seminars, but every time out of those 700 seminars, Randy, the majority of officers were there because they paid their own way.
Right.
And
exactly.
We made it our business to make it worth their while to learn. We started at 8 o'clock sharp. Generally, we started a few minutes early, and within 30 seconds, they were taking notes in their 100-plus page workbook and learning new things, because we knew we had them for only 3 days, and there was so much material that was learned that needed to be shared. I mean, I've had the honor of interviewing over 500 officers who've been involved in shootouts or have been shot or can talk about firsthand experiences related to this, often giving information that their wives never asked them about, or their departments, to dig deep and find out what can be done to prevent an officer getting hurt or killed, and not just talk about the fact that it's dangerous and there isn't that much support, but what can you actually do? And, you know, that became, just to comment on one of your earlier questions, that became very, very important, and make it in such a meaningful way that it gets retained. Because a lot of, you know, classroom material is worthless if you don't walk out the door and you have it in your mind in terms of how you can apply it.
Exactly. You know, and I want to get back to something that you brought up a little bit earlier, but I want to touch on a little bit. And that is about the way that When an officer is killed in the line of duty or shot in the line of duty, rarely are other officers allowed to understand why it took place. You know, we really don't want to go into it in depth, because very often, you know, a police officer makes tactical errors that lead up to the shooting itself. But the problem here is that if we don't look at that, then we don't learn from our mistakes, and then they are repeated over and over again. And yet there seems to be this huge reluctance to share this information.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a real problem. And in fact, one of the inhibitors of being able to make such material available is the well-meaning thinking of some that, oh my God, we can't put that out because, you know, the widow will freak that, you know, this information is now not kept proprietary. Well, I never talked to a widow in 22 years of being involved in officer survival training who wasn't eager to see that information shared, not hidden, but to see that it was shared. And for many, many officers, one of the things that I did very openly was I asked them, if you had it to do all over again, what would you have done differently? And they told me, you know, nobody's ever asked me that question. And I know of departments who have recreated how various shootings went down and never had the courtesy of asking the officer who was involved in the shooting to be tech advisor on his own recreation.
That's crazy.
It is. It's like unethical. So, you know, information definitely needs to be shared. What could have been done differently? What could have been done better? I'm sure there's officers who are confused about how the incident went down in Ferguson, Missouri. And the fact is, that officer didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
He had the absolute legal right to defend himself. And shame on the chief, the governor, the city council, and any of those other yahoos in local government for not mentioning the fact that a number of officers have died where the weapon used was bare hands. Doesn't have to be a gun or an edged weapon. But the press never brought that out. The community never understood that. So when people don't talk and they don't respond efficiently, guess what? Everybody fills in the cracks, and that's when the trouble starts. Because the assumption is made you're hiding something. Well, the fact is, they didn't know how to express effectively what had happened.
Yeah, and of course we saw the ramifications of that, which are still being felt to this day. You know, here's the other part of this equation. We have, with the use now of almost universally in departments around the country of body cams and dash cam video, there's mountains and mountains of information and lessons learned from critical incidents.
And, yes.
And yet, you know, I'm not seeing it utilized in any effective way.
Well, it's been a while since I've been in a department or academy setting to see exactly what is done, but I agree with your observation, and I also see in some of those videos a lot of reticence on the part of officers to even touch suspects. And that's where the trouble starts. If you're going to make an arrest, you have an obligation for your own safety to control that individual, handcuff them, and get them in the back end of a patrol car instead of wait 30 minutes for everybody and their brother to shoot with their cell phone, etc. You know, the fact is, people have forgotten that the word force is in the two words law enforcement.
That's true. You're right. And I think it's a very important topic here. That is, when you talk about use of force, it is the most misunderstood aspect of policing. And the reality is that if you don't use enough force at the outset of your encounter, instead of it diminishing, it's going to become exponentially more dangerous for that officer. That you have to use
good point.
Enough force in order to get
That's
that individual
point.
To comply. And yet there's a hesitancy now.
Yeah, the hesitancy comes out of city government not knowing what to do. So they figure, well, if less force is used, there's less possibility that somebody's going to be shot. Well, you know, that's a great fairy tale to labor under. And the fact of the matter is, going back to the very first law enforcement officer who was killed in the line of duty a long, long time ago, the fact is, patrol officers respond to a threat that a subject or an offender creates. It's not the other way around. So all of these screaming liberal types who are into revising policy and procedure manuals and keep talking about de-escalation and, you know, talk them to death instead of actually using physical control, which they have a perfect right to use. You know, this thing all goes in the direction of looking at the officer and demonizing him or her instead of, wow, what does the offender do that justifies using force appropriately? And that's what I tried and Chuck Remsburg tried for 23 years to see a change. And there was a change. And now it's all kind of retreated back. It's sort of like, you know, the administrator who jokingly used to say to staff under him, well, do whatever you want, but don't make a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how in God's name can you go out there and function decisively when you don't know what to do? And the fact of the matter is, and again, I would say this to any liberals, if an officer is injured or dies in the line of duty, part of that community dies. We know that. So the trick is, let's keep our officers alive, and then they can help with problems that exist. They can deliver babies. They can do all kinds of things. But they can also effectively manage physical threats from subjects who warrant an application of control.
And I think
that's really gotten forgotten about.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, one of the things that I saw that take place that I wrote about on my blog on Facebook, a police chief who ordered the cancellation of a street survival seminar. This is only about a year ago or so, because they were offering it in their in-service training, and someone in the quote community unquote said that showed the militarization of police. And so under pressure, she canceled the training for all these officers that had signed up for it and were basically paying for it out of their own pocket.
Oh my God.
It shows you how politics have come to play a huge role in the officer safety aspect of law enforcement, and of all the places
Absolutely.
That it shouldn't, that's where.
Well, given what the offenders know in the way of tactics and the kind of firearms that they've got accessible, the fact that law enforcement has been and always will be a paramilitary organization, what's the problem? I mean, there again, they look at all of this in a vacuum, instead of from the offender's perspective. That's what we've got here. We've got offenders who are so hopped up on drugs, on rare occasion, they have to be shot 10, 15 times so that the threat ceases. Well, in the old days, that was never the case. Well, it's different times. But the thinking hasn't changed on the part of local government. They just merely react to the fact, oh my God, you know, here's a subject and, you know, he got killed by the police. Well, why did that happen? That's got to be understood and sold and communicated to the community instead of running the other way around.
Yeah, well, it seems that the politics are playing more and more of a role every day in law enforcement, and what we're seeing is the ramifications of that are diminishing recruitment, diminishing retention, poor morale, basically depolicing, because you know, those who are serving, they're not stupid. They know that the last thing they want to be is the next YouTube sensation. And,
exactly.
And they know that they won't get the backing of their law enforcement administrations or their city, county, or state governments. So, of course, that causes inordinate amount of fear. And,
yeah.
And so they say, well, listen, you'll never get in trouble for the car stop you don't make.
Yeah. Well, that's where they shoot themselves in the foot, so to speak, because their communities are being cheated in terms of public safety. And that's one of the things that a person is entitled to when they live in a community. And if it's not occurring, you know, it's not the law enforcement's fault. It's just, you're right. All the incentives are headed in the wrong direction. So what do you do about that? Well, I'd take a real second look with who you're employed with. There's a lot of departments and a lot of them that are run well.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
The fact
you're right.
That, you know, this happens to be an agency that you were first went to and you stay here. No, there's all kinds of mobility. And I, you know, came across many, many departments that were highly progressive and did support officers openly and, you know, dealt with press relations in an effective way. You know, you see these people on television talking about what went down in a high-profile incident. And again, the human factor is completely missing in terms of who's who and what took place and why that took place. I mean, there's nothing wrong with educating the public on the fact that to use deadly force, you have to have intent, weapon, and a delivery system. And if you explain that all three of those were present when Officer X discharged his weapon, and the reason more than one shot was fired was because of this, that, and the other thing, you've now got some educated people who are seeing that this officer was not irresponsible.
Right.
And
exactly.
Again, you're fighting an ugly dragon with the news media. And, you know, that's why the IACP, National Sheriff's Association, the National FOP, these people have got to start being ombudsmen and supporters of law enforcement instead of hiding in the sand.
I couldn't agree more. And we're running out of time here, but I just...
Now, that's a shame, because I really enjoy this.
I know, and we could talk about this for days, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show. But I want to, you know, to say once again that you know, it's your dedication, your forward thinking back in the late 70s that had a tremendous effect on saving the lives of cops for generations, And Dennis Anderson, I just want to say thank you again for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Well, I'm honored, and I also want the listening audience to know that you have my deepest respect.
I appreciate that.
The finest people in this country are its law enforcement officers, and I honor you for every day of your lives.
Thank you.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to those men and women who have given their lives in the line of duty. This week I have one name to read. Police Officer Jamie Cox of the Rockford Police Department in Illinois. Police Officer Jamie Cox was killed during a traffic stop near the intersection of East State Street and Dawn Avenue at approximately 1 a.m. and dragged Officer Cox before crashing two blocks north of the initial incident. Despite suffering critical injuries, Officer Cox was able to call for assistance. Responding officers found him on the ground near the crash scene. He was transported to a local hospital where he succumbed to his injuries. The driver of the vehicle that fled was found deceased in the vehicle from a gunshot fired by Officer Cox. Officer Cox has served with the Rockford Police Department for 1 year and had previously served with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Division of Law Enforcement. He is a veteran of the United States Army National Guard. Police Officer Jamie Cox, Rockford Police Department in Illinois. End of watch, Sunday, November 5th, 2017. May you rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. Now, I'm your host, Randy Sutton. You can find me at Facebook. If you look under Facebook and you see Randy Sutton Public Figure, just like that or follow it, and you can see everything that I write and post. You can communicate with me there as well. I answer all of my messages personally. You can also find me at Twitter at LT Randy Sutton at Twitter. And you can find my books at Amazon.com. I have 4 books, and I think you'll like them. A Cop's Life, True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, True Blue to Protect and Serve, and The Power of Legacy. Thanks again.